This is an ABC podcast.
You've just finished school. You're ready to dive straight into work, get some more money, and finally start doing something you're actually interested in. Uni's not for you, so you take an apprenticeship. In the beginning, it's good, but pretty soon your mental health starts taking a hammering, and you can't do it anymore. G'day, Dave Marchese with you on Hack for Avenue Dias, and if that sounds like you, you're not alone. Almost half of all young apprentices don't finish because of things like workplace harassment, bullying, and because they're overworked and underpaid. Also coming up on Hack, how do cops know if you're incapacitated if you're caught with THC in your system after using cannabis? New research suggests they can't.
Hack.
If it can happen in Parliament House, it can truly happen anywhere.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about abusive workplaces this week. Yesterday, we found out more than half of people working in Parliament House had been bullied, sexually harassed, or assaulted. Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins led the investigation, which carried out hundreds of interviews. Current and former employees described Canberra as the most sexist workplace in Australia, like a year nine school camp with a bunch of naughty schoolboys and filled with lads who treat young women like fresh meat. Kate Jenkins joins me now. Commissioner, thanks so much for jumping on Hack.
Good afternoon, Dave.
A lot of politicians, including the Prime Minister, have admitted that they weren't really surprised by the findings of your review. What shocked you the most?
Probably a couple of things. One is, and I heard you talked about apprentices, the difficult experience for young people. So lots of people really aspire to work in the Parliament as it's the dream job. And lots of young people do, are lucky to get their dream job. They turn up and then they discover that it's just an incredibly difficult environment, working long hours under huge pressure, and the experience of bullying, sexual harassment and sexual assault. You know, one in two of the current workers there have experienced one of those things. So I think that it was shocking because we also did almost 500 interviews to hear of young people who arrive with such aspirations and who then discover this sort of dysfunctional behaviour is normalised, and who would then tell us after they left they would get to another workplace and realise actually that was really out of step with the Australian workplace. And some of them were long term, you know, really could never go back there because they were so distressed by their experiences. So that would probably be one of the most shocking things.
Yeah, well, like you say, young workers in Parliament seem to have been the most impacted by this harassment and abuse. Is that what you generally find across the board with workplaces?
We do find that young people are very much at risk, and that's because sexual harassment and bullying is driven usually by power imbalance and lack of accountability. And so young people are often starting out their careers. They might be in casual or part-time work or not secure work. And they're very dependent on the senior people for their advancement and even for keeping their jobs. So we do find young people are at risk. They don't have the same knowledge of their rights. They don't have the same ability to speak up. In Parliament, that's even compounded because they're worried for their jobs. They're worried for their boss. They're worried that their party will lose, you know, the election if something comes out. They're worried that media will report. There's just so many things that really drive against them speaking up. So they just take it and it's just not okay.
Was there any political party or side of politics that was worse in terms of culture that you found in your investigation?
Look, we weren't looking at particular parties, but the reality is our finding was the drivers are across the board. This is a systemic issue. And no matter who's in power or not in power, we spoke to people who are current but also former, and there are a lot of traits about the work environment. So we called them risk factors, but, you know, the fly-in, fly-out situation, the long hours, the work hard, play hard, the media scrutiny and the political sort of drivers that all added up to, and the power really, and power imbalance. So they apply to all, everyone in that place, all parties. And so we did hear of challenging experiences In all across the parliament. So there wasn't, you know, we weren't looking at this, but it didn't emerge that this is just a one side problem, because actually we know it isn't. It's a systemic problem.
We're hearing from some of our audience now. Daniel says, politicians are never held accountable for their actions. In my job, I bet I'd be instantly dismissed if I carried on like them. Another person said, Parliament, the dream job, full of self-obsessed, greedy people worried about feathering their own nest. I won't ask you to comment on those, Kate Jenkins, but your review made 28 recommendations, things like codes of conduct for MPs and staff, targets to increase diversity, but one of the ones that caught my eye was new alcohol policies. How big of a problem is booze in Parliament?
So, Dave, can I respond to those comments just, and then I will definitely talk to you about alcohol.
You definitely
can.
So
one thing I would say is that comment about parliamentarians and people who work in Parliament, I absolutely don't agree with that assessment. I totally understand the perceptions, but we heard of so many people who really had chosen to do this incredibly tough job because they wanted to make Australia better. And I guess having done this work and having heard from so many of them, I will stand up and defend actually a lot of them, not all of them, for their contribution. The second thing I was going to say is the person who said there's no accountability, we definitely found that that is one of the drivers, that there's been this sort of myth that you can't hold parliamentarians accountable. So our recommendations went to that as well. On the alcohol, we definitely heard that alcohol is a player here. It doesn't cause the harassment, but it definitely creates risks. And we've made a recommendation about, policies about its minimisation, really to match other corporates. Because one of the key things about those younger people that we talked about is particularly younger women had to do so much to protect their own safety, particularly when alcohol was at social events. So they would really literally protect each other, make sure that they weren't in environments with particular older men. You know, they were really unacceptable pressures on them.
All right, Commissioner, Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins, thanks so much for coming on Hack.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Hack. Like being in that position, of course, you're on shit all money. So you see more money opportunity, you're like, yeah, okay, I'll take that.
On Triple Jack.
Well, from Parliament to apprentices, we keep hearing stories about bullying and mistreatment of apprentices. And a lot of those stories have come from you, Hack's audience. Today, a new report has shown just how badly that mistreatment can affect the mental health of apprentices. One in four leaves their job because of workplace bullying. For more, here's Shalila Medora, and just a warning, there is some bad language coming up.
I'm Italian, I love cooking, I love food, I understand it. I like hard work, and it just seemed to fit.
Sarah from Melbourne always wanted to be a chef. So when she left school in year 10, she decided to take on an apprenticeship. Straight away, it wasn't what she expected.
And, like, the hours are long and the pay was, like, terrible. I think my first year I was getting, like, $9.60 an hour, and I was working in, like, a 50-degree kitchen for 12 hours a day.
And to make it worse, the people she worked with were verbally abusive.
The owner of the restaurant is pretty aggressive, and, you know, the way he talks to you, like, you just wouldn't take that anywhere else.
So Sarah left. She thought, hey, it's just one restaurant, I'll try again. But the next place she worked at was so, so much worse.
One particular time, I bent down to get something out of my fridge and I could hear the sous chef talking to the commis chef, like whispering, like, oh, don't you just want to grab it? And then I turned around and they were looking at me.
Sarah was the only woman working in the kitchen, and she was subjected to sexual harassment from a bunch of other employees, including the bartender.
And he just harassed me over and over and over, like, let's just fuck. Like, and I couldn't report him. I can't report the chef because they're all friends of HR. They're all the bosses are all friends.
That feeling of being unsafe at work really took a toll on Sarah's mental health.
I just started not wanting to come into work and getting really depressed and taking days off because I just didn't want to be there and I didn't want to be around these men that did respect me.
Ultimately, the experience of being an apprentice forced Sarah to give up on being a chef.
So that was like my chosen career path that I've had to abandon, which is sad for me because, like, that was like a dream for a very long time.
Sarah's story is hectic, but according to a new report by Origin Youth Mental Health, It's sadly not unique. The research found 1 in 4 apprentices left their jobs because of workplace bullying and harassment. It also found that financial stress due to low pay can have a massive impact on mental health.
It was almost expected, like, to work for free type thing. Like, you could work 4 hours, 5 hours overtime, and all you get is like, oh, thanks for that.
Josh gets that. It's fair to say that he didn't really enjoy his experience as an apprentice Sparky.
It was dog shit. It was just shit out.
He's worked at 3 different businesses, including for a boss who loved to play mind games with the apprentices.
He was just hot and cold constantly. He'd tell you to do something, you do it, then you turn around and have a go at you. It was almost like you were being set up to fail.
Josh reconsidered his future several times.
For a year into it, I'm just like, does this ever get better? Yeah, you kind of hit like a mental breaking point where you're like, this is so shit and this is not worth it.
He stuck with the apprenticeship, even though it messed with his mental health.
Just waking up every morning, struggling to wake up, you're just depressed, knowing you're just about to, you're driving 40 minutes or so just to cop abuse for the whole day.
The apprentice is saying, well, I don't like going to work because, my boss yells and screams at me all day. Or my boss swears at me and throws tools at me in front of other people. So we just got this really strong story across all the focus groups that this was going on.
Dr. Victoria Ross is from the Australian Institute for Suicide Research and Prevention at Griffith University. Earlier this year, she looked at the mental health of apprentices specifically working in construction. While the vast majority had pretty good experiences, Dr. Ross's research found a concerning number of apprentices who didn't.
We found that around 30% of apprentices from our sample reported that they had experienced bullying.
The researchers asked apprentices if they'd thought of suicide in the last 12 months.
Yeah, around 30% of apprentices report that they had, which was quite alarming.
Dr. Ross said the culture on a lot of work sites, particularly where older tradies dish out what was given to them, adds to the pressure on apprentices.
For a lot of them, they felt like it was a rite of passage, that it was something that you just had to take and you had to live through and everybody had to go through it.
And Dr. Ross reckons things are starting to improve for apprentices across the board, and that's due to generational change.
The younger bosses were less likely to have that bullying attitude because it seemed, and possibly because it wasn't that long ago since they went through their apprentices. They spoke of these old school tradies who seemed to be the perpetrators.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora reporting there, and some pretty full-on stuff in there. Remember, if you are struggling, there's always someone to talk to. Lifeline's on 13 11, 14, we're hearing so much from you now. Someone says, I thought my capacity for resiliency in the face of other men was pretty high, but then I started working in the mines and I realised that wasn't true. I called in sick one day and I never went back. Another person says, I was an apprentice and then spiralled into a deep depression and alcohol. Someone on the line, Liam from Maroubra. Liam, what was your experience?
Yeah, I had some pretty average bosses, and they would leave me at work from 9 o'clock in the morning. And I'm trying to learn and try and become a builder. I was a carpenter. I am a carpenter now, but I got left at work at 9 a.m. and just had pretty much taught myself my whole apprenticeship.
And what kind of impact did that have on you? Did you keep going? Did you pull out?
Well, it was my only option. So I had to finish. I kept showing up to work. Ended up taking sick days off like most of the other people that you've interviewed before, and it just turned into a deep, deep depression, among other things.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Liam. Your story, yeah. We're hearing from so many other people. Someone says, in regards to the apprenticeships, is this an apprenticeship bias or an age bias where older, different generation workers think they can mistreat younger, less experienced workers? We just heard a bit about that. Someone else, I'm a female chef and couldn't stand the mental and physical stress in the kitchen. It pushed me to run my own hospitality business. Now I own my own business. Trying to change the industry, at least for me and my employees. That was from Laura in Melbourne. Let's go to the author of this research. Cameron Boyle is a senior policy analyst at Origin, and he joins me on the line now. G'day, Cameron.
G'day, how you going?
Yeah, well, thank you, mate. Your research found almost half of young Australians won't complete their apprenticeship because of the impacts on their mental health. What kind of things are turning them away?
Well, I mean, I can't tell the story any better than I just heard before on the line from sort of Liam and Josh and Laura. It's those stories that you hear all too common about mistreatment in the workplace, poor conditions. All of this can have a spiraling impact upon a young person's mental health and can lead to them leaving their apprenticeship.
Are there some industries that are worse than others that you found?
Yeah, some of the quite traditionally sort of male-dominated industries, so construction is one that we see some pretty poor results from, but it is quite a sort of broad-ranging issue. It's something that's seen across industries.
Now, the stats, are they the same for men and women that you found?
They're relatively similar, yeah. Withdrawal rates do tend to be quite high, and they're often, as I was sort of indicating before, that they're related sometimes a little bit more to the industry. So we might see gender impacts from that. So more male-dominated industries like construction, they tend to see higher rates of young people leaving. But then also, you know, more female-dominated industries like hairdressing also have really elevated rates of young people leaving.
Let's hear from another one of our listeners. Beck is an apprentice dental technician. Beck, what was your experience?
I'm 35, female, going back to school, got a job as an apprentice in a lab, really male dominated, about 30 technicians. There were two females. I was number three. The verbal abuse was ridiculous. And I shared a story with my boss, who was meant to be my mentor, about my brother having Down syndrome and how special he is to me. And so he's next time he was mad at me, he was really hot and cold, he called me a retard.
Wow, unacceptable on so many levels. Beck, thank you very much for calling in with your experience. We're hearing so much, Cameron Boyle. Corporate settings often have big HR departments to deal with things like employees' mental health, but an apprentice might only work with one other person. What can be done to address some of these issues in such a small team environment?
Yeah, this is a really tough one, and we're actually not 100%, you know, from an Origin point of view, we don't have the answers to this sort of question ourselves, because ordinarily, you're exactly right. The bigger companies, they've got a lot of places you can go in order to seek the help that you need. But for a young person in a smaller place, they've got to rely upon external support networks, and it's really inconsistent to the degree which they're available. Places like WA and Victoria have quite good apprentice support helplines, but they aren't everywhere. So often apprentices are, you know, needing to go back to their original group training organisation, and there's a lot of inconsistency there about the supports that are available.
So what sort of things can be done to improve the mental health for apprentices? What are you recommending?
Yeah, there are three main things that sort of Origin's recommending in the report. The first one is better data. The government doesn't keep any information on why it is that apprentices leave. And what it means is that in terms of responding to this, we're all dancing in the dark. Until we know more about why it is or what's going on with why apprentices leave, we're not going to know what can be done to help them, you know, help it be a more fulfilling experience. The other one is just better evidence into what supports are needed. There's so many different approaches out there, but very little research examining how they can best be tailored to support young people completing an apprenticeship. And probably the third one, and we were talking about this a little bit before, is just help out, you know, help for small and medium-sized businesses.
Going to hear from someone else. Fraser, you said that you were fired or you couldn't, you were told, sorry, you couldn't go to your grandmother's funeral. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We were told we had to give 6 months notice for annual leave days. I was told I wasn't allowed to go to my grandma's funeral because she wasn't classed as immediate family. Just so many things that contributed, to me. Still thinking about my time as an apprentice there to this day, and that was, 3 years ago that I left.
Yeah, that's what we're hearing, Fraser, that these memories are sticking with people and it's turning them away. Cameron Boyle from Origin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Someone says on the text line, to be a good employer, you need to be a good leader. A lot of the people out there running trade businesses have zero leadership qualities or leadership education.
People who have a prescription for cannabis, and yet they will be detected, and as a result of taking their medicine as prescribed, they'll be off the road.
On Triple J.
Well, thousands of people are pinged by the cops every year for driving under the influence of cannabis, THC. But some new research suggests that the test being used doesn't actually show if someone is incapacitated or not. Tamsin Rose has more.
So weed sort of fits in my life a bit more recreationally, but also as something that I definitely use to sort of aid my sleep and ease my anxieties.
This is Sam. That's not her real name.
I would say that I'm quite regular in my use as an after-work relaxant.
She smokes weed pretty often. And she also drives a car, knowing she could be randomly pulled over by the cops and tested.
It is a concern knowing that it is in my system if I was randomly THC tested and it could have been a day or two since my last smoke.
She says she'd never drive while smoking or if she felt like she was under the influence. But she's kind of unclear what a test would show up if she was stopped.
It's definitely something that weighs on my mind a little bit, knowing that could affect me.
And turns out Sam's worry's pretty valid.
My name is Danielle McCartney and I'm a postdoc researcher at the Lambert Initiative for Cannabinoid Therapeutics.
Dr. McCartney's been researching the link between driving performance and concentrations of THC in blood and saliva. THC is the intoxicating bit in cannabis.
So we found that these biomarkers of cannabis use were not particularly good indicators of impairment.
So someone could be high as a kite and totally unfit to drive, and the test might come back to indicate they weren't, and vice versa. And that's got experts worried. These tests are used when cops pull people over to see if they're okay to drive and are used as the basis for charges.
If those biomarkers aren't associated or particularly well associated with impairments, it can mean that they're not necessarily identifying the right people.
Unlike with booze.
Blood alcohol concentration is reasonably well correlated with impairments and also crash risk for drivers.
And people with entirely legal prescriptions could also be snagged.
In New South Wales, well, there's 250,000 tests going to be done this year. About 8% of those will result in a positive test. Many of those will be people who have a prescription for cannabis who are actually permitted to use it, and yet they will be detected.
This is David Holpern.
As a result of taking their medicine as prescribed, they'll be off the road, have a criminal conviction, and, you know, may well lose their job, lose their family.
David was a magistrate for 21 years until he resigned a few years ago.
I could no longer handle the silliness of our drug driving laws. Silliness is probably flippant because really they had an incredible impact on people's lives.
And these new findings, well, they don't surprise him at all.
I would see and still see hundreds of people charged with this offence. And in not one of them was there an allegation that they were ill-affected or under the influence or adversely driving because of their use of THC medicine or otherwise.
David's calling for an overhaul of the laws right around the country and a change to the way politicians and cops talk about road safety.
If we can stop the rhetoric and stop pretending that this is about road safety and stop pretending that this is not actually about prohibition.
He wants to see laws that are fit for purpose, that acknowledge the new findings.
No one is arguing that people should be able to drive weaving all over the road while they're stoned. Those laws will always remain. And blood tests and expert evidence can always lead to conviction for those offences.
As a starting point, he wants to see states follow Tasmania's lead in creating a defence for people using cannabis products on doctors' orders.
That would ameliorate the real difficulty for medicinal cannabis patients.
And scientists like Dr. McCartney are working on other ways to work out if someone is intoxicated and shouldn't be behind the wheel. That could include a behavioural test that'd work in a similar way to the old walk in a straight line test for drunk drivers.
There's all kinds of creative things going on in this space. I mean, it is important to acknowledge that we don't currently have fail safe or a foolproof method of identifying cannabis intoxicated individuals.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, keen to hear your thoughts on this one. Have you lost your license after one of these drug tests? Maybe it picked up something you did ages ago. Let me know. 0439 757 555. We're already getting some comments through. Reese says, I know one guy who went a week without smoking because a cop told him it would be long enough. Then he still got done for weed in his system despite having no impairment at all. Another person says, I got done the morning after smoking weed. I was positive roadside and then taken to the police station where I tested negative. The police drove me back to my car and let me drive away. Then a few weeks later, I received a summons for driving under the influence of THC and I was convicted. Look, let's chat to someone who knows a bit more about this. Professor Ian McGregor is an expert in cannabinoid therapeutics. Ian, thanks so much for joining us on Hack.
Good to talk to you, Dave.
These tests used for THC, it seems like they're failing to do what they're supposed to, which is keep people safe.
Yes, it's very difficult. I mean, the temptation is to think of cannabis in terms of what we know with alcohol, where you've got this very clear correlation between the alcohol levels in your blood and your driving impairment and also your crash risk as well. And with cannabis, it's just a much more complicated story. And the pharmacology and what we call the pharmacokinetics, the way that THC moves around in your blood and in your body and your saliva, is really complex. So you can't get this very clear linear relationship between THC concentrations in your saliva and blood and your impairment. It just doesn't work as well as alcohol does.
Because there's probably a lot of people who are wondering how long THC stays in the body. It seems like there's no real answer to that.
Well, there is. I mean, there's been some studies done, some classic studies actually, where they locked people up for weeks who were heavy cannabis users and ensured they had no opportunity to consume cannabis. And the answer can be as long as 6 months. You know, if you're consuming heroic levels of cannabis, that it may take as long as 6 months for you to give a negative urine test or blood test. And that also adds complexity to assessment of driving impairment, because the THC in your blood may well reflect a joint that you had weeks ago if you are a heavy user.
What about, is there any way of telling how affected somebody is by THC from a test? Can you do that in any way, or is it just this behavioural test we're hearing about that should be used?
Well, Danielle's done this amazing study where she condensed everything that's ever been done on THC concentrations in saliva and blood and impairment. And basically what she found was it was a very weak relationship. So generally, if you have higher concentrations, you are more impaired, but it's a very weak correlation. And it only applied to people who are occasional users of cannabis, you know, so people who use less than weekly. If you're a heavy user, then the relationship just tends to break down. And I think a part of it is that the effects of cannabis on driving are actually very subtle. It's not the type of impairment you see with alcohol. On some measures, cannabis users almost look more safe in their driving. They tend to drive more slowly and leave a bigger distance between them and the car in front. It's just if something, you know, complicated happens or something very sudden happens, they may well be impaired under those conditions. But again, it's not like alcohol where we have this very simple relationship, and it's really hard to fathom. In terms of behavioral impairment, I think the best thing I've heard is people standing on one leg with their eyes closed tend to find that very difficult if they're intoxicated with cannabis. You might try that at home if you're an enthusiast.
Yeah, I reckon a few people are probably trying it now. We're hearing from Ash, who says, I have chronic pain and used to use cannabis for pain relief because it's the only medication that helps my crippling pain. But she says, I don't do it anymore. I'm terrified of it showing up on a drug test and potentially losing my job. I guess they're the kind of stories that you probably hear about all the time, Ian.
We hear about them all the time, and this is such a major disincentive for people who otherwise would be helped so much by medicinal cannabis, people with insomnia, with anxiety, with pain. They're just terrified of losing their license and getting a criminal record. And the strange thing is that, going back to Danielle's findings, if you're a regular user of cannabis, it's very hard to show impairment. And almost by definition, if you're a medicinal cannabis user, you're probably using it daily. So we desperately need to do research studies that look at whether there actually is any impairment in people who are using medicinal cannabis for pain. In fact, cannabis, by relieving their pain, may in fact improve their driving, because pain itself can seriously impair your driving ability.
All right. Professor Ian McGregor, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome, Dave. Great to chat.
And that's all for the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you tomorrow.